You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Eric Weiner has spent a decade working as a foreign correspondent for NPR, and so he found himself stationed in some of the world's most troubled countries. And then he decided to flip everything around and devoted a year to traveling to some of the happiest countries in the world. He shares that journey in The Geography of Bliss, One Grump's Search for the Happiest Place in the World. It's published by 12. It is my pleasure to welcome Mr. Weiner to the show. Hello.
And it's a pleasure to be here.
Are you really a grump?
I am. And, I mean, you may be looking at me and thinking, why is this man a grump? Good-looking guy, works for NPR, lovely wife and child. I'm probably closer to being a malcontent, but my publisher thought malcontent was maybe too many syllables and sounded vaguely French, so we went with grump.
And is that a reason that you become a foreign correspondent?
Yeah. You know that old expression, write about what you know? I mean, that's, think about
trouble.
It. Trouble. Yeah, what does a foreign correspondent do? You travel to the least happy countries in the world and you seek out the least happy people in those unhappy places, and then you hang out with them for extended periods.
So how does a grump like you come up with the idea to travel to the world's happiest places?
Well, I mean, how does a hungry man come up with the idea to go out to dinner? You know, it's sort of the same thing. I was motivated. I was tired of being a grump and sort of wallowing in my own misery and the misery of the refugees and orphans and war victims and other people around me. And so I thought, what if I spent a year traveling around the world seeking out the happiest countries and not the least happy? It's the complete opposite of what a foreign correspondent normally does.
Is this travel writing or another form of journalism?
Yes. It definitely is. I mean, does travel writing have it almost has a fluffy connotation, doesn't it?
Well, it all depends. But there are a lot of good travel books, and
right.
they're always praised right. for being unlike all the other travel
exactly.
books.
Exactly. There's always an asterisk next to it. It's travel writing, asterisk, you know, but good travel writing.
Right.
And I think good travel writing is simply good writing, and that's what I've tried to accomplish here.
Is this a book that's more about happy places than happy people?
Well, okay, when we say happy places, what do we mean? Do I mean there's something in the air or there's some energy? You know, not necessarily. It's about the culture, essentially. When I say the geography of bliss, I'm talking about cultural geography. You know, I'm talking about not just the mountains and the climate, although I talk about that. It's about how different cultures define and pursue happiness and how much culture matters, national culture.
So, to some degree, it's what you determine is going to make you happy, and then whether the place delivers it. Because some people are happy everywhere, and there's some people who are unhappy everywhere. But it's the standards by which they live. The United States concept of happiness would be different than
right.
the British concept of happiness.
Right, I think so. And I don't know if people could be happy anywhere. I don't know if those people could be happy in Baghdad. I mean, I think there are places where it's very difficult to be happy, and there are places where it's easier. And there's also this notion I write about cultural fit. That, you know, some people are just not happy growing where they were planted. You know, I meet people like this on the road. An American named Jared living in Iceland, grew up in America, stopped in Reykjavik in the capital of Iceland on one of these stopovers, you know, on the way to Europe, spent 2 days there, fell in love with Iceland, and then he's decided he's going to pick up and move there. And he's been living there for years, and he's happier in Iceland than he was in the U.S.
But then there's a place like Qatar, one of the places you visit, that doesn't have a culture. It has to create a culture. So. What is the culture there?
I mean, I went to Qatar because I wanted to sort of use it as a laboratory, you know, in a way. What happens if you take a poor country and the entire country wins the lottery, the natural gas and oil and natural gas lottery? And they're fabulously wealthy, but you can't – money can buy a lot of things. As I say in the book, it can buy sort of a future, but it can't buy a past. In other words, you can't sort of create this heritage that didn't exist. And they're trying in Qatar. They – you know, the sort of running joke there was there's a big sign that says, your cultural heritage coming soon. You know, it's sort of
they're
like...
They're building museums, but it's not...
They're building...
Museums of their own indigenous work.
They're Muslim, you know, Islamic cultural museums and things like that. And they import a lot of performers and writers and singers. And, I mean, it's not their fault. They're living in this little spit of land on the Arabian Peninsula. But, you know, when countries become very wealthy very quickly, just like people who become very wealthy very quickly, they're looking not just for comfort but for validation, and money can't quite do that.
Isn't there a developing science of happiness?
There is. In fact, I started my research at a place called the World Database of Happiness in the Netherlands, and when I first sort of stumbled across that in a Google search, I couldn't believe it, you know, World Database of Happiness.
Yeah, how do you determine something like that, which is so subjective?
I was skeptical at first, but, you know, the happyologists, or these are psychologists and sociologists and economists who have decided to study happiness, they claim to have an empirically sound and very reliable way of measuring our happiness, which is basically they ask us, how happy are you? On a scale of 0 to 10, 0 being miserable, 10 being ecstatic. And, you know, not at this moment, but overall, you know, take your happiness temperature. And they say that we're pretty good at it. And if you think about it, if you don't know how happy you are, then who does? I mean, it is a subjective thing, but that doesn't mean that it can't be measured broadly.
But they found out that most of the people in the world think they're happy.
That came as a real shock to me. I mean, I thought most people in the world are
since there's
happy.
So much poverty, there's
right.
so many so
I'm
much
a person,
turmoil.
I'm not happy, right? Happy meaning above the median of five, right? I mean, there's great range in terms of how happy they are, but you know, if you picked up a newspaper, watched you know the TV news, you wouldn't think that most of the world is more happy than sad. But that's the fact.
Should we read anything into the fact that this institute is located in the Netherlands, which strikes me as kind of a pleasant place, although they may be less happy when global warming hits and they have to deal with the floods.
Suggest that they were smoking something in the Netherlands, and that's why.
Well, that could be too, because as you walk down the streets of Amsterdam, you smell an awful lot of marijuana coming out of the various cafes.
Right, right, and I explore that at some length in my chapter in the Netherlands. The Dutch they score high, but if there's. And if there's one word that would sort of define Dutch happiness, it would be tolerance. Tolerance towards others, tolerance towards things like marijuana and prostitution.
But that's changing, isn't it? After all, with the immigrant population and the assassination of a right-wing politician who was preaching intolerance.
I touch upon that. And, you know, it's funny. People will say to me, you know, you go to the Netherlands, you go to India, you go to these places that have problems. What can they teach us about happiness? And I think that misses the point. I mean, I am, you know, just as a foreign correspondent, will ignore the good news about a place and focus on the bad news. I've done a bit of the opposite here. I've gone to these places. I know they're not perfect. You know, the word utopia comes from an old Greek word that means both good place and nowhere. And I think that says a lot. There is no utopia, but there are places that are happier than others, where the people are happier. That I think, is a fact.
My guest is NPR's Eric Weiner, whose book, The Geography of Bliss, is published by 12. So this institute has a list of the happiest countries mm-hmm. in the world. We don't rank near the top, do we?
No. And there are various surveys done, but we don't come out in the top five. One survey done by the University of Leicester in the UK ranked us at 23rd.
Mm-hmm. But behind Costa Rica?
Behind Costa Rica, Malta, Malaysia. You know, still out of 200 countries, that's good.
Wait,
but,
Malaysia,
you know,
there isn't a lot of Malays in Malaysia?
Good one. But, you know, the problem with being number 23 when you're an American is we're used to being number one, you know, in a happiness superpower. We're not at the top, and we are about four times wealthier than we were in 1950, but statistically no happier.
So what are the main things that people say make them happy?
Other people. And this is something that came as a bit of a surprise to me. I mean, Sartre said that hell is other people, but he was probably hanging out with the wrong people. We think of happiness as being such a personal thing in this country. In fact, we use that term, personal happiness. I'm going to work on my personal happiness this year. It's January, lots of New Year's resolutions out there, right? And I met a man named Karma. And it's not every day you meet a man named Karma. I mean, it's a happy day when you do. And he was a remarkable man from the country of Bhutan, PhD from Cambridge University, yet very grounded in his Buddhist and Bhutanese culture. And he said, Eric, what is this talk of personal happiness you have in America? He said, happiness is not personal. It's 100% relational. And I thought that either that mountain air in Bhutan was getting to him, or he was exaggerating to make a point. But by the end of the book, I came to the realization that he was not exaggerating. Well, happiness is other people.
And Bhutan has a national policy of
gross
happiness.
National happiness. That's their policy.
But, you know, I believed it. And everything that I'd heard about Bhutan made it sound great. And then I do a series called Underreported about the stories that are not told. And there, for the past 17 years, over 100,000 Bhutanese refugees have been living in camps in Nepal because the king has been trying to impose Bhutanese culture on them, and they are originally of some Nepali group.
And I am well aware of that, and I made a conscious decision actually not to include that in the book because I thought it again, it's a country with a problem. I mean, it's not a Darfur-level problem by any means. It is a problem. The Bhutanese are not perfect. And this is sort of the problem when you have a country, though, with a policy of gross national happiness, is there's this assumption that everyone in the country is going to be happy. And I put that to a Bhutanese minister. He said, look, doesn't mean we're all happy. It just means that this is our goal and this is our objective.
Well, Switzerland's another country that you visited, and it sounds like it's a terrific country, efficient, punctual, people have a lot of money, there's little unemployment. Also, others have described it as the place where you get chocolate and cuckoo clocks.
Yeah, the cuckoo clock was invented in Germany, but that's okay. It's the Swiss get credit for it. It's also boring, isn't it? I mean, it comes across as boring, and so I sort of...
Is it boring?
Well, I mean, it appears boring to an outsider, but I wonder if the Swiss are bored. I think they're quite content. I mean, and I sort of what I'm trying to do in this book is explore the different flavors of happiness. And the Swiss flavor of happiness is this sort of deep-seated contentment, sort of contentment plus. See, it's hard to describe happiness. In the English language, and indeed in every language in the world, there are many more words to describe unhappy states of mind than happy ones. And that's why I actually found it challenging to, for instance, describe Swiss happiness, because they're not joyous, but yet they're content. So I invent this word of conjoyment, where they're contentment plus enjoyment. And that's sort of what they are. They also vote on time and often, 7 or 8 times a year in referenda, so they have a real say in what happens. They do eat chocolate, which triggers some serotonin in the brain. And they love their Alps and their land. They have this connection to the land.
Many of the places where people are happiest mm-hmm. are homogeneous.
Yes.
Bhutan, except for the Nepalese.
Right. Iceland.
Iceland in particular. Mm-hmm. But Switzerland is made up of people who speak three different languages.
Three different languages, but essentially one religion and one standard of living for the most part. I mean, it's linguistically diverse. They have an immigrant population. But it's not quite the melting pot that America is. And you're right, though, that this is sort of one of the politically incorrect findings out of the World Database of Happiness, is that the happiest countries in the world are homogenous, and that's not what we as Americans think of as the ideal for happiness.
But New Yorkers all talk about how much they love the diversity of this city. We probably are the most diverse city in the world. London can make a case. They have, I think, have more immigrants, but we have more people from different parts of the world here. And I don't think New Yorkers are particularly unhappy.
No, and that's why I did take the findings from the science of happiness with quote marks around it with a shaker full of salt, because they're a snapshot. And, you know, maybe if you could be a diverse place like New York and be happy, you've achieved some deeper level of happiness. But, of course, we don't have the words to describe that.
So. Now, you say Moldova is the least happy country in the world.
Yes, and I went there to find out why.
That's a country that's between Romania and Russia.
Romania and Ukraine.
Yes. And Ukraine.
Yes, and it is.
Why is it unhappy?
You know, if you go to Moldova, which even sounds unhappy, doesn't it, if you say it? If you go
sounds
there,
like a made-up place.
It does.
Which it is. It's just a
it is
country.
A made-up. I mean, there was a book about Moldova by, I think, a man named Charles King, and he called it a stipulated nation, I believe was the title. And it is stipulated. It was invented by the Soviets, and it's sort of Romania plus some Russification, you know, Russification. If you talk to the Moldovans, they'll say, oh, we're unhappy because we're poor. And, you know, they're not that poor compared to Africa, compared to sub-Saharan African nations. In fact, they're much wealthier. But they're poor compared to their neighbors, compared to Western Europe or even Eastern Europe. And that's the thing, is Moldovans are not comparing themselves to Tanzanians. They're comparing themselves to Romanians and to Germans and to Italians. And that's what we do as human beings. We compare ourselves to our neighbors. Deprivation is always relative. It's never absolute.
Now, I wasn't surprised by Switzerland, Bhutan, Iceland, but Thailand, India, Great Britain, they did surprise me.
Well, they're in there for various reasons. Thailand I went to partly because it has that reputation of being the land of smiles, and I wanted to explore that, and I wanted to...
Exploitation of women, I always think of Thailand. young women who are sold into sexual slavery. Maybe that's
nothing happy,
the cliche.
Nothing happy about that. But that doesn't define Thailand, and it doesn't define Thai happiness, and it doesn't mean that Thailand can't be happy. I mean, look, a lot of the countries around the world that are the happiest also have the highest suicide rates. And that seems like a vast contradiction, doesn't it?
Well, no, maybe you can't live up to the national standard.
That's one reason. If you're unhappy in a very happy country, you feel like, God, what's wrong with me? If you're unhappy in Moldova, you fit right in. And there are other reasons why. And there, you know, Thailand has problems. But Thailand, what I found fascinating about Thailand, besides the variety of smiles, they have 12 different kinds of smiles. So Thais will smile at a funeral. A smile can indicate unhappiness as well. But this notion in Thailand, they have an expression that translates as you think too much or don't think too much. And that floored me because I always thought that the route to happiness was paved with much thinking. And the Thais live a very non-introspective, what's the opposite of introspective? I don't know. Non-introspective life. I mean, and I think that's one of the keys to happiness is don't
extroverted.
I guess so. Hmm. Yeah. But don't think too much about happiness or you won't be happy. Don't buy too many self-help books or you won't be happy.
And India is a happy country despite the
India
poverty?
India is a country.
And the religious wars and all the rest.
India is a country. What I explored in India was, here's a country that is, on many levels, as you say, unhappy, but it's a country that Westerners think they'll be happy in. You know, and I wanted to explore this notion of the Beatles and E.M. Forrester and myself going to an ashram and saying, you know, I'm going to be happy here. And, I mean, again, India, the subtitle of the India chapter is Happiness is a Contradiction. And they, Indians are able to hold two contradictory thoughts in their mind at the same time and without their head exploding. That's key.
Are you less of a grump?
How do I seem?
You seem perfectly pleasant to me.
Yeah, okay. It's an act. I am less unhappy, to be honest. And that's not quite happiness. But I have picked up pointers along the way. The Thai example I was just speaking of, don't think too much. I find myself thinking less and happier for it.
Eric Weiner will be giving a talk tonight at 7 o'clock at the Rubin Museum of Art at 150 West 17th Street between 6th and 7th. His book, The Geography of Bliss, is published by 12. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's been a pleasure.